Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, here I am, Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very pleased to have as my guest Rebecca Solnit, whose newest book is called Recollections of My Non-Existence. It's a profound book. It moved me deeply. And let me say furthermore that this is the first time we're doing a show under these coronavirus situations. I'm in my home. Rebecca is in her home. And we're going to talk to one another without being able to see one another. A real first for Bookworm. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, Michael.
What do you mean by my non-existence?
I had the title before I wrote the book, and the book in some ways is a reflection on it. It's most of all about all the forms of violence against women, the literal violence that leaves some women dead, some women silent, some women pushed out of full participation in different social arenas. But I also wrote about other social groups, gay men, Native people, etc., who face other kinds of erasure. And I also wrote about reading as a positive form of non-existence, where you withdraw from your own life and your own physical being to enter another world and kind of float disembodied in somebody else's imaginings and somebody else's language.
Wow. Let me say that as I was reading the book, although I regard myself as, I hope, a sensitive gay man, I was made aware of how frightening it is. You say, at a certain point, partially ironically, that in your childhood your hobby was not getting raped. To what extent is that true?
I mean, it's completely true. And I was really writing about my adolescence and early adulthood. We've had a really valuable and significant conversation in the last several years, thanks to Black Lives Matter and the response to the killing of Trayvon Martin, about Black parents giving a talk to their sons about the dangers they faced because of their race and gender. Most girls get different forms of the talk, telling them often in roundabout evasive ways that they can't wear this, they can't do that, they can't aspire to this, they can't move freely, they can't go out at this hour, they shouldn't go to the party, they shouldn't have a drink, and that it's entirely on them to prevent men from harming them, and that society has no interest in taking responsibility for the epidemic of violence against women. So as a young woman, I had to constantly think about safety and strategy as I move through the world and every situation, walking out in the world, public transit, meetings, classes, social situations, parties, etc. And it was constant and it took a toll.
I remember when I was first in college, this is around 1970, the first feminist movements were starting, and it involved stickers that said, "This exploits women." But it wasn't yet clear that we were in a culture that exploits women altogether, and that when I started to join gay men's liberation groups, we discovered how much we had grown up being teased, being hurt, being disregarded in the language of the normative, patriarchal, heterosexual culture. How does one live in such a culture?
You know, I think if you add up those who are not male, those who are not white, those who are not straight, those who are not conventionally able-bodied, etc., you end up with the majority of us facing these forms of non-existence. I think that you know, it is a burden that people shouldn't have to carry, but that a lot of kinds of people carry these burdens. And I wrote this book partly to try and home in on some of the nuances and complexities around gender that I didn't feel we were talking about enough. But I also wrote this book very much as a first-person account of my formative years in San Francisco. And gay men were a joy and support and inspiration in those years. You know, I lived about a neighborhood away, you know, a 15-minute walk from the Castro. To see these men who had said, we are going to refuse our assignment, we are going to refuse our role because we've decided it's worth paying the price rather than the price of avoiding who we are and conforming. But I also want to talk about another form of non-existence that really had an impact, and I think has an impact on young queer people, even now, on people of color, the non-existence of being given reading material, stories, histories, in which people like you don't matter, don't exist, aren't the protagonists. I grew up reading a very male-centered, white-centered literary canon, and I should say Christian-centered, and I feel like there was a non-existence in that to imagine myself as the protagonist of the great stories. I had to de-imagine myself as a woman, and it always felt like I was wavering between who I was in my bodily identity and who I was if I wanted to be like Odysseus or Lord Jim or so many of the adventurous people in the books that I love.
When I was growing up, they used to, as a regular thing on one's book reports, ask, who do you identify with in this book? And since there were no queer characters and no Jewish characters, except extremely negative ones, as in the case of The Sun Also Rises, I mean, Hemingway was a particular culprit for giving us no one that we could know who would be like us, who we would want to grow up into. And my parents, in turn, they were the children of immigrants or immigrants themselves, and they were given Ivanhoe to read when they got to school, and suddenly they were saying words like, prithee, young maiden, and where did that come from? They weren't learning American English in their English classes. They were learning Sir Walter Scott. So when I was reading your book, Rebecca, this idea of non-existence and the ways in which it's pressed upon us moved me so deeply that, I'll tell you the truth, I was breaking into tears every 10 or 15 pages.
Wow. Well, thank you. I will say, if I'm not mistaken, Ivanhoe has a beautiful Jewess named Rebecca in it, but it is a very anachronistic, archaic book.
Rebecca Solnit is an explorer of the American West, and when she became involved with her younger brother in anti-nuclear demonstrations, she was there at the test sites in Nevada, exploring what it was like to be on Shoshone lands, yes?
Yes, and actually that was such a formative place for me. I'd like to say the Nevada test site taught me to write because the place was so extraordinary. It demanded I learned to integrate the different modes in which I was writing journalism, criticism, and kind of lyrical personal essays, but also it was a place in which the protagonists were Western Shoshone elders, Mormon downwinders, atomic survivors from Japan, lesbian pagans and anarchists, and just a really remarkable coming together of a lot of people who already weren't part of the central narrative, to exert real power, make real alliances about the future of the world against the dominant narrative being told by Cold War America and the nuclear physicists and politicians who were mostly white men. And it was an extraordinary movement with many repercussions.
I'm talking to Rebecca Solnit. She's the author most recently of Recollections of My Non-Existence. It's published by Viking, and I think it's an absolutely extraordinary book. The very first thing you see in this book, Recollections of My Non-Existence, is a picture of a very beautiful desk, white desk. Can you tell about that desk, Rebecca?
Yes, it's the desk that was given to me by a friend when I was 19. That's been my writing desk ever since then, you know, almost 40 years ago. The woman who gave it to me the year before she gave it to me had almost been stabbed to death. She had broken up with an abusive boyfriend, and to punish her for daring to take her own well-being rather than him into consideration, for daring to protect herself from him, he tried to kill her, and he very nearly succeeded. It took a lot of blood transfusions to save her life. And even afterward, she was blamed for it, and he was never punished. And when I knew her at the time of the desk, she had these long scars all over her body. And I think also about how little reaction I had to that, because violence against women just felt so ordinary, something you needed to figure out how to survive, but that nobody around me was protesting, advocating against, etc. There was a powerful feminist movement with people like Susan Griffin talking about violence against women, but it hadn't reached me yet when I was 19 and 20 and 21. So I really became a kind of lone protester. But the fact that my desk, on which I've written, I think it's 24 books at this point, and everything else, love letters, manifestos, political documents, emails, my student essays, and then my notes to my students in writing classes, that all of it was a platform given to me by a woman a man tried to silence, made it feel that in some way everything I'd written had been a mission to counter that attempt to silence a woman by making some noise in the world as a woman, and making noise specifically about how much violence against women is violence against voices, against the voice each of us has that should be our capacity to bear witness to what's happened, often denied when women are told we're delusional, subjective, unreliable, vindictive, crazy, etc. The voice with which you set boundaries, in which you say yes or no, consent or refuse consent to what happens to you.
When I look at that picture, it's a desk the size of the first desk my parents gave to me when I was 12. You write about one particular morning in which you woke up and wrote a particular essay virtually uninterrupted in one draft called Men Explain Things to Me. And from that point on, this was not published. It was put on the web. It went viral. It expressed something that many people knew how to feel. And it made your name as a writer, although you'd written many books before it.
I was, you know, doing just fine and pretty well known by 2008 when it came out, and then again came out as the title essay in a Haymarket Books anthology in 2014. But it definitely raised my visibility a lot. And I wrote that when the desk that's pictured in the book was holding up a 17-foot-long desktop when I was living for a few years in a big attic apartment. But the story of the essay is that my wonderful friend Marina, who is staying with me, taking refuge from an abusive spouse, told me the night before when I was joking about writing an essay called Men Explain Things to Me, as I had for many years, that I really needed to write this essay because this was an experience so many women had and tended to think that it was them rather than that it was an ordinary, ubiquitous experience. And so because Marina was slept in the other half of this attic I lived in and didn't wake up as early as I did, I just got up the next morning and sat down to write it at the desk and was surprised with what poured out. It begins with a very funny anecdote about being at a party a friend takes me to, where I know nobody, And the host, who's pompous, tells me to tell him about the books I've written. And I mentioned my most recent, River of Shadows, is about Edward Muybridge. And he interrupts me to see if I know about the very important book about Edward Muybridge. And he wants to tell me all about it while my friend keeps saying, "That's her book. That's her book." That's a really funny story. It's just kind of ridiculous, and it makes very clear.
It's a horrible story.
It's the way we live. It's sort of horrible, but it's sort of funny because, like, nobody is being seriously harmed in that moment.
Yes.
But what surprised me when I sat down and wrote the essay that morning was that one of the anecdotes that came up a few, you know, paragraphs later was about a story I'd been told by a nuclear physicist when I was young, because there's a nuclear weapons lab in the Bay Area, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and I had a boyfriend then whose uncle was a nuclear physicist. At the holidays, he told me a story about a neighbor running out in the middle of the night screaming that her husband was trying to kill her. And he told it as a very funny story, laughing at her. And I said, "How do you know that her husband wasn't trying to kill her?" And he said they were middle-class white people. Therefore, that she was mentally ill was an obvious assumption, because that her husband was trying to kill her was something he couldn't conceive of. And I know a lot about domestic violence, and it is very likely she ran out in the middle of the night because her husband was trying to kill her. And here was a neighbor who couldn't conceive that she was a person with the capacity to perceive reality. But how often having a voice, having credibility, is a crucial issue in survival. And until we had cell phone video, we had so little evidence that the police, you know, we had first-person stories, which some of us believed, but it was the cell phone videos of police shooting people in the back and saying that they were running towards them, not running away, of all the unjustifiable killings that helped people say, maybe the police aren't reliable authorities. Maybe we need to listen to the victims.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. In my residence, this is the very first time I've taped a program at my home. I'm speaking to Rebecca Solnit at her home. I'm very honored to do so. We're talking about Rebecca Solnit's new book, Recollections of My Non-Existence. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Rebecca Solnit about her new book, Recollections of My Non-Existence, A Radiant Portrait of a Writer Finding Her Voice. But not just finding her voice, invoking the possibility of others finding their voices as well. And one of the things that's most impressive to me about your work, Rebecca, is how generous it is to its readers. As I said, as I was reading, I kept identifying and crying at the state you were in, that I was also in, that any creative person is in when looking for a voice. If you add to that the political subjugation, not just of creative people, but the political subjugation of victims. You're talking about what it's like to grow up deprived of your right to be heard. To what extent do you think that has changed?
You know, I wrote a book on hope, and I found that hope was a very difficult thing for a lot of people to understand, that they think often if you say things have gotten better, you're saying everything is great and we can all go home and it's a victory and a finish line. And they think if you know, if it's not the finish line, then we haven't started and we've lost and we're defeated and it's impossible. I think things have gotten a lot better. I think the full implementation of Title IX on campuses better during the Obama era than the present one to address campus sexual abuse and racism matters. I think just the rise of other people in charge of what stories will be heard, the rise of more rights granted to queer people, people of color, and women under the law and in various professional and social arenas, workplaces, universities, schools, etc. And, you know, to say nothing of addressing the rights and inclusion of trans people. At the same time, it's only a beginning. It's better than it was. It's better than the world that I was born into. There's still so much more to be done. And the book is really two things. It's a personal story about a particular and in some ways eccentric individual, me, and my trajectory in becoming a writer and finding a particular voice. But it's also a very generic story of me as a pretty typical woman in my experience of voicelessness, not only in being a target of menace and threat and harassment and assault, but also then not being believed in the publishing world as well as in other arenas when I reported that this stuff was happening. And I think the last several years has seen an extraordinary feminist insurgency that's opened up a lot of space for women to tell their stories and for us to learn from them, to see this is really common, this is how it happens, these are popular myths that we have now debunked, these are things we understand better. And so I feel like it's been a revolution since 2012 around gender in particular, and it's been a revolution through storytelling in particular, but it is only a beginning. We're neither defeated nor victorious. We are on our way.
I only started reading Willa Cather around 8 years ago, but what a writer! How do you suppose she was able to do it in those cases where you find your voice? How does that happen? How does it become possible? How does the door get opened?
And Willa Cather is such an extraordinary figure because she's a lesbian who lived with her partner for much of her adult life, and she managed to have a very successful career in magazine publishing before she went freelance as a novelist and then won the Pulitzer Prize and was a very acclaimed novelist who wrote from, you know, the perspective of a man in masterpieces like Death Comes to the Archbishop, as well as the perspective often of women, and sometimes both in some of her novels. I mentioned in Recollections of My Non-Existence, a novel of hers, it's so remarkable. It's more than 100 years old. It's about a girl and then a young woman who's extremely ambitious, keeps the company of men, has a free erotic life, and is one of the most gifted singers of her era. And so often in the books by men that I grew up with, women get punished. They get punished for having their own desires. They get punished for wanting to be independent. They get punished for being talented. They get punished for wanting to serve their own, you know, desires and interests, for doing anything other than being a doormat to some man. And this is just a great novel from, I think, 1918 or 1919, where the woman doesn't have to be punished.
You and I are both at home because of the coronavirus. What do you think? It seems to me that this isolation is the doorway, the introduction to a new culture. And we're going to throw out the way we have lived and find a new way. Are you feeling that?
I am. And of course, first of all, my heart goes out to all the people who are going to be so impacted by this crisis that is as much a massive financial collapse for so many working people, as well as a health emergency for some of us. But I do think we're going to look back at how we were living, wonder why we were so busy, why we had to move around the world so much, why so much consumption and production went on. First of all, we need to make sure that everybody has enough, because the problem in the U.S. has never been absolute scarcity. We've been a very wealthy society for a very long time. It's been a problem of distribution. And that existed before the pandemic, because we had so many working people making minimum wage who couldn't even afford to rent a modest apartment on their wages. So many people who were working in precarious, lacking health care, going hungry, unable to pay off their debts, etc. I think we're going to rethink economic distribution in a big way. I think a lot of people are also going to re-envision the ways in which we're connected, the ones that are beautiful and valuable, in which we're inseparable from each other socially, spiritually, culturally, and the ones that are dangerous around how illnesses circulate, problems circulate, you know, and it may give us a new perspective for addressing things like climate change, which in some ways resembles this, except it's moved more slowly, in which we need to change everything, in which what some people do impacts what happens to everybody. And so I don't know how it will be different, but I did also write a book about disaster called A Paradise Built in Hell, mm-hmm. about the pro-social ways people come together and organize. And one of the things I learned is that disasters often begin very suddenly, but they never really end. You never really go back to the day before 9/11, the day before Hurricane Katrina, the day before the San Francisco earthquake in 1906. Some of the changes can be terrible. Some of them can be wonderful, depending on who's in charge and what the vision is. But there are always lasting and lingering changes. And I think we won't know exactly what they can be in some cases. In some other cases, I think we can decide what they're going to be by how we organize, how we envision, how we tell the story of this very moment.
Rebecca Solnit, I think you're a wonderful writer and a beautiful person. And I think that that information is coming to readers of your books through the clarity of your voice. I've been talking with Rebecca Solnit, author now of Recollections of My Non-Existence. It's published by Viking. It was edited by one of my dearest and earliest friends in publishing, Paul Slovic. Thank you, Rebecca, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael. Be well, and thank you for reading.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm. for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple and Spotify and other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's own smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan, who did an amazing job in learning the technology that allowed us to do this today, my associate producer and editor, Alan Howard, and technical director and all-around marvel, Mario Diaz. I'm grateful to you all. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Harry Dodge is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.